Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guests tonight are Samuel Machado and Cynthia Sousa Machado. They are cartoonists whose work explores politics, law, identity, rights, and social justice themes. And we're talking about their new graphic book, Thing, Inside the Struggle for Animal Personhood. Cynthia, Sam, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you for having us, Mark.
Thanks.
First of all, this book totally surprised me. It's one of those things I didn't expect there would be a graphic treatment of the subject. It's a very complex subject, and I actually, people when they hear about it might think it's a joke. It's actually a very important subject, and it has far-reaching consequences. How did you come across the story?
So that was really interesting. We were writing and drawing a webtoon, an online comic, for years, dealing with consciousness, but from the point of view of artificial intelligence, and it was kind of a sci-fi pastiche. It was sort of very different in tone, but it was in the same ballpark. And the executive director of the Non-Human Rights Project stumbled on one of our earliest cartoons about law and the importance of law. And they just thought, wow, you know, these guys might be the only people who could understand and deliver this information in a creative way. And he reached out to me and turned me on to the work of the Non-Human Rights Project, which we had already followed. But when I met Steve, and the two of us sat down with Steve at lunch about a month later and really laid out what's going on in courtrooms the evidence that they're coming in with, all this cognitive evidence that they're coming in with, and that courtrooms aren't even interested sometimes. And that really blew us away. And we were just like, well, this is a subject that has an angle that we've never thought about before that people don't understand is the biggest impediment right now to helping these animals.
It's like I said, this is a story, a idea, a concept about animal personhood. And by the way, that doesn't mean an animal is a human and has the same rights as a human, but it does have some rights if it's declared a person. It's the story of, the core story is the story of Happy, who's a 51-year-old Asian elephant in the Bronx Zoo. Fill in the gaps after that about why Happy becomes the center of all these legal proceedings.
Oh, wow. So, you know, Happy's been at the zoo now for so long. Happy has spent almost her entire adult life in this small space about an acre. And she originally was sharing it with four other elephants who didn't really know each other. She had her companion that we believe she came from Thailand with. But the other two elephants, total strangers. And they're all trapped in this small environment, living together, and they're not socializing well. So on and so forth. And it leads to years of little problems here and there. And the Non-Human Rights Project started to see that Happy at the Bronx Zoo was in a really desperate situation. Her companion of many years had died. Another elephant had to be euthanized. Now it's just her and Patty, and the two of them are isolated in the same, you know, small enclosure. And so they can't really interact. They can't do anything a normal elephant can do. The zoo's already said they will no longer have elephants at the zoo, that this is not the place for these animals. And the Non-Human Rights Project thought that that would have been a good indication that they might be willing to think about moving Happy to a place that was better suited for her, like sanctuary. And, you know, this has been a long-standing question that the Non-Human Rights Project keeps on bringing up to judges, which is, does an animal like Happy, so similar to us in cognition and in some ways much more advanced than we are, emotionally, spatially, do they deserve some basic right to their own bodily liberty, to be in an environment better suited to them rather than an environment that suits our needs. And, you know, they haven't been able to get a clear consensus from New York judges yet, and they've moved on to having this question in other states too, Massachusetts right now, and Colorado and California. And, you know, that's kind of how Happy got here. Happy is actually the first elephant to pass a mirror self-recognition test, which is the test we give children to see if they have a sense of self and a sense of personal identity. And so that made her a great candidate to bring to the judges to say, hey, we know she's self-aware. We know she has a sense of identity. You know, does this give her some basic right to bodily liberty?
Well, first of all, the whole idea of this challenges an awful lot of the human history, and namely our relationship with the natural world, and the creatures that live in it. The whole history of humanity has never been, for the most part, to consider the lives of the animals that live in it besides us to have any kinds of rights, any kinds of consciousness, and to even consider the fact that they might even have a mind and what the implications of that are. So all our societies are built on the fact of treating these things as things, which is why the book is named this. So these issues get to the very core of our relationship to the rest of the living world. One of the things I want to say is, this is a very unique graphic book, and I want to talk to Cynthia about this. It contains a lot of legal proceedings and a lot of philosophy. It has to have been challenging to try to come up with visuals.
Well, you know, Sam helped me a lot with that.
Still, executing that is no mean feat.
It is not a mean feat. I make everything look pretty. So
I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't go there. You make it look visually interesting.
I try to convey to other people what it would be like to be able to see all of this themselves. We went to several court proceedings ourselves. I was amazed at some of the answers that the judges gave to Steve during some of these court proceedings, both on the negative side and the positive side. Yeah. I was really impressed with Judge Tewitt and her willingness to listen to all of the arguments being given and to really get a grasp of what he was trying to say. And, you know, on other court proceedings, it was a very negative type of a situation. So I wanted to convey that to the reader. I also wanted to take them to wherever they needed to be, because if you don't love it, you can't save it. So if I could actually show people and demonstrate to people what I wanted them to see, what I could see in my mind's eye, and give it to them, that was really my goal.
It's interesting because in the back of the book, you talk about, both of you talk about, or write about, I should say, you wanted a book that had the feel of a documentary.
Yeah.
Talk to me about storyboarding. Was it really hard storyboarding? It's a nice, thick comic, by the way. So it really is a book. But, I mean, that must have been tough to storyboard this whole story out.
Yeah, I think storyboarding was
permutations. Yeah,
yeah. The storyboarding was my department for a long time, particularly with the philosophy and the history stuff. The way we worked it out was really I had to stop writing the book every time I tried to write the script and describe visuals. It didn't work. So I'm an artist by trade. I learned to write because someone has to write the graphic novel. I started just drawing the graphic novel in those difficult pages and those difficult concepts and didn't even worry about the words. I just said, how can I communicate this totally with pictures? Then I'd hand it over to Cynthia and say, well, what do you think? I'm trying to say this. And she would take my sketches of the pages and come back to me sometimes in an hour, sometimes in days. So, you know, it wasn't like it was a page a day. This was really sort of a labor of love. And Cynthia would come back with these fleshed out pages that just would blow my mind. She'd take my idea and then find a way to turn it into something that if we were to have filmed it, it would require, you know, a several million dollar budget for the just for the work. And her mind had a way of taking my abstract concepts and turn it into something that I find, I feel like you could take almost every image, print it on a poster, and put it up on your wall as a standalone image, and it would work.
Yeah, Cynthia, you work digitally, right?
Yes, I work on my iPad. I work wherever I go, so I have to be mobile.
And also, I was fascinated that you quoted as sources Stanley, Jack Kirby, and Steve Ditko.
Absolutely.
Come on. You're not old enough to remember Ditko's work, are you?
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not. Because I am old enough to remember Ditko's work.
I was born early enough. Yes, I believe I was.
You really evaded that question. That was great. Love that. Jack Kirby, the master of the foreshortening.
Oh, Kirby Crackle. Got to know the Kirby Crackle.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And his weird shadowing. It's like, yes. I don't know. Yeah. I'm happy to say that I like your artwork more. But let's talk about the book. Although happy, and by the way, because she was one of seven elephants that were captured in Thailand, they were named after the dwarves in Snow White. Happy is the center of the story, but it touches on a lot more other animal consciousnesses or animalhood, personhoods, including orcas, including chimpanzees and bonobos. And so this is not just a problem that's just like about one elephant. This is a problem about a lot of animals that have now been shown through science to have things like to exhibit empathy, intelligence, and consciousness. I have to believe that, and this comes up in your book, that when you compare, you know, we have humans in our society who may be non-functional, maybe they're in a vegetative state or they're too young or something like that, who don't have the same amount of intelligence and compassion, but they're still having rights.
Absolutely. This is one of the Non-Human Rights Project's first objections to rulings that you had to possess the capacity and the rights and responsibilities reading of the definition of personhood, that with personhood, with legal rights, comes legal obligations to society and to the courts. For example, we all have to appear in court when summoned. We all have to serve in jury duty. We have obligations to follow the rules of the road. That comes with our privilege of driving. And their concept, a lot of early courts' concept, was that you had to be able to fulfill those responsibilities to also have legal rights. And some of the first objections were, but we have so many humans that do not fulfill those capacities
right.
and have these legal rights. We don't even question that our elderly, who might not be capable any longer of making decisions for themselves, have still some rights. Our children, who are not capable of making all their legal decisions for themselves, have still bodily liberty and some certain other rights. You know, and so how do you make that distinction? And courts really failed to answer that question, and they're still failing.
And that's what comes out in your book, because you have actual transcripts, sections of transcripts from the court proceedings. And it's like, it's one of those things, it's like they never thought of this problem. You know what I'm saying? It's like you get the feeling like the problem is so basic to our sense of being what a human is, that the idea of giving a chimpanzee these rights seems bizarre.
Yeah, I believe.
Well, it always has been when we actually start in a society where, you know, we actually put these animals in our society.
Yeah, I know.
But this is not a natural society. It's not a natural world that we live in. If we were to live in their world and we tell the tiger, don't eat us, they have every right to eat us. So it doesn't work in reverse. So when you bring them in here, you have to have some kind of a structure in place for them.
Now, the term habeas corpus is central to this argument. Can you explain why?
Yeah, so habeas corpus literally means to bring or free the body. And it's an old term. It goes way, way back. to really, we think, probably before the Magna Carta in concept. But, you know, the essential idea originally was that the king or queen would have a right to know what is happening to their subjects and to always be able to advocate on their subjects' behalf and intercede in an almost an extra legal way. And over time, this became a bedrock of what we consider basic liberty rights. You cannot just pluck me off the street, toss me into, you know, a prison cell without explaining to me why this is happening, without giving me access to counsel, without allowing me to see a judge, and without allowing all this to be public. I mean, we have exceptions, obviously, national defense, terrorism. By and large, you know, this is a bedrock of what we consider liberty in the modern world for any human being. And so habeas allows you to go before a judge and say, hey, we think that somebody's rights might be being violated due to the conditions of their imprisonment, and we would like you to take a look at it because we think this might be somewhat of an extra legal situation that requires a little bit of finesse and a little bit of literally the very definition of the word jurisprudence. And so, you know, this basic law, when it has been suspended in society, has always come at a lot of debates, a lot of questioning. In some cases, Supreme Courts, you know, our Supreme Court has on occasion ruled that the president, you know, during the Civil War did not have the right to suspend habeas corpus, you know, and so to suspend that right for any human being, it's just so sacred, so fundamental. And what, you know, the Non-Human Rights Project has been arguing, Steve, and then in front of the New York Supreme Court, Monica Miller, argued was that this fundamental right should extend to anybody with autonomy who has a brain like ours, and that we have taken responsibility for by bringing them into our society in a way that they cannot advocate for themselves, you know, and that fundamentally is the question. Does a being like Happy, like Lolita, who just passed away here in Miami, the orca kept at the Miami Sea Aquarium, do these kinds of animals have that fundamental quality that should give them access to habeas corpus to challenge the conditions and say there might be an extra legal situation here that we should be looking at?
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guests tonight are Samuel Machado and Cynthia Sousa Machado. They are cartoonists whose work explores politics, law, identity, rights, and social justice themes. And we're talking about their really incredible new graphic book, Thing, Inside the Struggle for Animal Personhood. One of the things I found really interesting in this book, among many, is that you sort of try to trace the history of humans' attitudes towards animals. And you sort of make some guesswork about the prehistoric, but then you're on more solid ground in ancient Greece, like Socrates and Aristotle. Mm-hmm. What did they think about animals? Did they have souls? Did they have brains or what?
Well, I think if you ask 50 ancient philosophers, you're going to get 50 different answers, and some might give you multiple choice answers.
Those wily ancient Greeks.
Right. But Aristotle really left us the way we look at it legally, and the way we did look at it legally for a very long time, the way Christendom has sort of organized his philosophies, and that's what's left to us today. That's our, for lack of a better term, our default, you know. And that default is that animals themselves had what was considered to be a very basic soul, a soul that could only really want for food, want or crave for reproduction, want or crave for sleep. They didn't even believe that they could really feel pain the way the rest of us did. And one of the fundamental reasons why they believed that was because man or humanity is fundamentally different than all other animals. We are closer in ascendancy to heaven. We are closer to the perfect ideal than these brute animals, as they were often called by the ancient philosophers. And, you know, because of that, they deserved a lower place in the legal order, and their concerns were not as important to the functioning of society. You know, what we needed them to do was to pull wagons and to plow fields, and they naturally served that role for us because we were in some way endowed with a more sophisticated soul that could write poetry and architecture these sort of things. And that obviously led to our, you know, natural superiority was the way to look at it. And
well, a lot of that also doesn't have to do with theology, where they looked at humans as the crown of creation.
Yep.
And therefore everything else that was on the planet was there for us to use.
Yep. And so this concept that it's been given to us for us to adjudicate as we wish has led some to believe that, you know, we can do anything we want with it.
Well, and the other thing that's pointed out in your book, which is very critical, is this filters down to attitudes of how people looked at serfs and slaves.
Yes.
Could you just elaborate on that?
Yeah, absolutely. The Greek philosophers were the first to really make that comparison between a human slave and a animal slave. And I think it might have been even Socrates, according to some of his biographers, who really talked about it this way, that to them, they saw almost little difference between a human slave and an animal slave. Both were possessions. Both were things. Both were incapable of more sophisticated thought, according to their point of view. And therefore, the laws that were written to cover what was legally acceptable for a slave, naturally extended to other brutes like animals. They were all thrown in the same capacity, even if you were a human.
That's right.
Did not matter.
That's right.
And that has become the legal framework since ancient Rome, which established these precedents and have been reinterpreted over and over and over every few centuries, but still based largely on this original schema that a possession is a possession because they are a lower being. And for us to use in the natural order of things. And we've really never deeply questioned that implicit bias when it comes to the natural world.
I know.
You know? So does the redwood forest have a right to exist?
As you bring out in the book here, there's a river in New Zealand that now has personhood.
Correct.
What is the implication of that?
So I would think, and, you know, this is probably actually a really good question for Cynthia to answer, but I would think, you know, one of the first big implications of this is we have to reevaluate what has a right to coexist and what should our relationship be with other right holders that maybe aren't sentient or maybe don't possess our level of intellectual sophistication.
I would argue that level is not a good word, but kind. Because I would look at cephalopods as creatures that have definitely intelligence. It's just very alien to our kind of intelligence.
That's a very good way of putting it, too. You know, one of the things that Cynthia has been thinking about in her own research, in her own studies, and again, I'll let her answer this question. But, you know, if you have a body that has different sensory organs than a human does, it has different needs, and it perceives the world differently.
Yep.
And it's incumbent upon us to take those considerations into mind. Maybe you can explain.
Cynthia, can I ask you about that?
Sure.
I'll tell you, and this may sound off flip, but it's not. I actually don't eat calamari or octopus anymore.
It
sounds funny, but I was interviewing Cy Montgomery, who I've interviewed many times before, and she wrote a book about getting to know an octopus at the the Boston Aquarium and the New England Aquarium. And I had sort of known this all along, but the implications were for me that this creature has a mind, it has consciousness, it's not our consciousness, it's a different kind of consciousness. And as soon as you start thinking, it's not a matter of how much intelligence, but what does it have intelligence, then this really opens up to things greater than even elephants or orcas, to a whole range of creatures.
Absolutely. I have a love affair with orca. You know, that's one of the things that...
Oh, and they were horribly mistreated.
Absolutely. An entire pod of orca in Washington State were depopulated for the most part, just for what we did in the 70s, of taking these orca out, these children out of their parents. It was... It was basically just taking that entire society apart. They took an entire generation out. So the population is down. Plus, the Chinook salmon is not available for them to eat because we keep on damming up all the rivers. We're not looking at this from the standpoint of the actual animal itself. When you look at an animal that can hear sounds for so far across the ocean, and it's all of its language is based on sound, you have to think that that animal thinks very differently to you and I, who actually have everything visually handed to us on a silver platter. These animals need certain reductions of sound. They can't have so much vibration in the water, and here we are having our boats and everything come back and forth. They can't hunt properly. You know, all of these things have to be taken into consideration. When you think about the embodiment of the animal and how it experiences its environment, all of these things have to be taken into consideration, also in understanding their languages.
Hmm. What would be the best outcome for Happy?
I think probably the best. Yeah, I think the best outcome for Happy would actually not be another legal battle, but for the Bronx Zoo to sort of say, hey, we're retiring Happy anyway. We have never contested the science that Happy is better off in sanctuary.
Put her in like an elephant sanctuary that has a huge amount of space. And lots
exactly.
Of,
and there are several available. We talk about one in the book.
But we're going to have to stop there because we're out of time. So people are going to have to read the book, which has got the advantage to also being a beautiful book to read. Tonight, my guests are Samuel Machado and Cynthia Sousa Machado. They're cartoonists whose work explores politics, law, identity, rights, and social justice themes, as this book does. And we are talking about their new graphic book. It's really fascinating and interesting and beautiful to look at. Thing, Inside the Struggle for Animal Personhood. Cynthia and Sam, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having us, Mark.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.